Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, July 16th, and I'm your host, Kara Santamaria. Now, remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. That's my model. It's never going to change. It hasn't changed in over 4 years, and that is because those of you who can afford to support the show do so. I have a hybrid model. I read ads on the show, as you see, and I also really do rely on the support of individual patrons like yourself. If you want to support the show, all you have to do is go to Patreon, that's patreon.com/talknerdy, and look at all of the different options. And with the top tiers of support, I give you a shout out on the show. So this week, I want to thank Rob Schreck, Phil T-Bear, the Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell for your support. All right, guys, we have a really fun episode coming up. The first one in a while that I got to do in studio because I got to interview somebody who is somewhat local, although I do thank her for making the long trek to my place up in Los Feliz all the way from, actually, I don't know where she lives, but all the way from the work that she does in the Bay. So her name is Heather Burdick. She is the Director of Marine Operations for the Bay Foundation. And she really works with the Marine team, supporting them on a lot of different projects involving research, monitoring, and ecological restoration. So one of the things that we're going to be really diving deep into, no pun intended, she dives a lot, is some restoration water quality projects throughout the Santa Monica Bay watershed that she's been working on since 2005, including the Palos Verdes kelp restoration project and also abalone recovery efforts here in Southern California. So if you're into ecology, oceanography, conservation, all of that good stuff, this episode is for you. So I guess without any further ado, here she is, Heather Burdick. Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so excited because this is the first time I feel like in months that I've had somebody in my home studio. I've been recording remotely with everybody lately. And in a way, it's great to record remotely because it means I can talk to people who live across the world. But in a way, it's not as fun because I don't get to look at them. And so this is nice because we're in person and we get to have a real human chat, a human connection. So I don't know if you remember, but when I first met you, I was working for SoCal Connected and I was doing a piece on, we were doing a piece on kelp and on sea urchins. It was years ago. When was it? Do you remember?
I think it was probably 2015.
What? Okay. Yeah. It was like years ago. I definitely remember that.
It was pretty early on in our kelp restoration project.
Okay.
And you came out on the boat with us.
I did. So that's the thing. What do you officially do you, I mean, I'm sure you wear a lot of hats with the Bay Foundation, but what do you officially do?
Officially, I manage all of our marine restoration and research projects at the Bay Foundation.
So you yourself are a scientist who then manages all of the science projects.
For marine programs. We have other folks who do our watershed work.
Gotcha. What's it? What? Okay, so marine programs would involve like water ecosystems?
Yeah, so our main projects are the kelp restoration project off Palos Verdes. We're working with abalone restoration. We also get to fly in small planes looking at fishing activity along our coast and just really anything off of our coast that we're concerned about, ocean acidification, climate change issues.
Gotcha. Okay. And then when you say watershed, you're talking about the water. Like when I think of watershed, I think of water table. That's not the same thing, is it?
It's part of it.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Anything, all the streams, rivers, creeks going to the ocean.
Anything that's not ocean.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes more sense. So you do ocean, and then other people do things that aren't ocean.
Right. And then there's a blurred line in the intertidal sandy beach area where we work together.
So. Yeah. Where that water becomes sometimes brackish and different organisms live around. Okay, I get it. And then, of course, I guess I kind of buried the lead in that the Bay Foundation is something that I think a lot of people who live in California, or at least in Southern California, are like relatively aware of. They've heard of it, or maybe it's just because I'm a nerd and I have a lot of nerdy friends. But probably a lot of people listening to the podcast might not know what the Bay Foundation is.
Yeah. So we're a local nonprofit in Los Angeles. Our mission is to improve the water quality of Santa Monica Bay, not only for animals, but also for people so that we can enjoy it as well.
I mean, I love that. And I love that that exists. And it seems so obvious that something like that would need to exist, but it also bums me out that it has to be like a nonprofit organization that does that, that this isn't something that the government is doing, or that it's not something, it's something that like individual people had to make the decision to say, you know what? We need to set higher standards. We need to make sure that we're on top of this.
The one unique thing about us is that we're actually part of a national estuary program that's administered by EPA. So we do have a federal connection.
Gotcha.
And then we also receive a lot of funding through state and federal grants. So, you know, the nonprofit is doing the work, but we're definitely working with agencies.
That's good to know. That's good to hear, too. It comforts me a little bit more to know that this is not something that had to be developed because, quote unquote, the powers that be weren't doing enough.
Yeah.
That it's just a good way, I think, to have like a private public sort
of. And that's
focus.
Exactly what we are. EPA realized that, you know, the people who live there and work there know best how to manage it. So by supporting us, we're doing the work that EPA wants done. So.
Yeah. And it's also good to hear that the funding still exists and that EPA is still focused on things like this.
Every year it's up for question, though.
For sure. You know, I have a lot of friends who work at JPL and they have this similar kinds of experiences because JPL is public-private. Like, it's technically NASA, but it's also kind of Caltech, and it's also private funding. And of course, they're not a non-for-profit, so they don't struggle quite as much. But they definitely, every year, it's like, ooh, are we going to be on furlough?
It's
like, oh, God.
But so that's coming to work on Monday.
Yeah. No, that's really good to hear. That makes me feel good. And I must ask then, are you, obviously you're local now, you live here and you work here. Have you always been a Southern California person? Like, what drew you to this area?
No, I grew up in upstate New York.
Oh, wow. That's a huge change.
Huge change.
Yeah.
But I moved here when I was 19.
Okay.
And I always knew I wanted to do something in the environment. Where I grew up, I lived next to one of the most polluted lakes in the world. And that kind of spurred the, oh, we need to do something to change it. How do we help it? So when I moved here, I started working on California ecosystems and trying to do what I could here.
So when you were, okay, you moved here when you were 19, you said, so you probably weren't, like, were you partway into college or had you not started yet?
I hadn't started yet.
Gotcha. Okay. So you weren't already doing research on that. What was the lake called?
Onondaga Lake.
Onondaga?
Yeah.
And it was super polluted. Was it a Superfund site?
Yes.
Oh, yay. There are a lot of those in the Northeast, aren't there?
Yeah, and we have one off Palos Verdes.
Awesome. And that happens because usually of like industrial runoff.
Yeah, this was a paper mill company that was dumping mercury into the lake. So
it reminds me, there's a book, I don't know if you can see it right on my bookshelf there, Tom's River by Dan Fagan. Mm-hmm. He won the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago for that book, which is all about a river in New Jersey called Tom's River that was downstream from a dye company.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all these cases of brain cancer and it was getting into the water table and there was a lot of government cover up and a lot. It was a very poorly managed situation. So it had intrigue, it had secrets, but it also had a lot of really interesting conversations about, guys, it's 10 a.m., which for me is very early, and I'm not quite caffeinated yet, so I'm thinking of words. Epidemiology and how complicated the math can be behind epidemiology and how it's never that straightforward to say this environmental problem led to this many,
right,
you know, health issues because there's a background rate and you have to cut blah, 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 blah. So it was, I don't know, it's a really fascinating read in case anybody's interested. But it also kind of shows you how prevalent the pollution from these kind of human activities is around the country. And of course, as you know now, I mean, you knew then, but you really know now, it's not just in the self-contained systems. Like, our oceans are really sick.
Yes.
Really sick.
Yeah. And Los Angeles has done a lot to clean up our water, and our bay is much healthier than it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So there's progress, and we should be really proud of that. And keep going
Absolutely. That's a good thing. You know, the ocean as a whole is sort of a really important sink for a lot of reasons, right? It's a really important modulator of climate change. It's a really important ecosystem in and of itself. There's so many organisms that live there. There's a certain sort of homeostasis, equilibrium, balance, as it were, that has to be maintained. But the ocean's really good at helping maintain that. But climate change and runoff and pollution and different things that we have done, fishing, I mean, are really stressing that out, not just in bay regions where we think of like that kind of intersection between people and nature, but like even in the deep ocean, like far away from where we think of there being any human activity.
Right. We've pretty much have touched all of the ocean.
Yeah.
Without even realizing it.
Did you read that article recently where they found like a plastic bag in the bottom of the Mariana Trench?
I did.
Ugh. Yeah. That's so depressing. So I've got to ask then, what kinds of projects are you guys focused on with the Bay Foundation? Is it about cleaning up pollution? Is it about restoring ecosystems? You know, when we first did that story, it was about, maybe help me remember.
Sure, yeah.
The kelp was in a bad way because there were too many urchins?
Yeah, we had too many urchins have taken over our rocky reefs off our shores. And that's a global problem. It's not just a problem we have locally. So we identified 152 acres off of Palos Verdes that were in urchin barren state, which means that devoid of kelp, too many urchins. We had upwards of 100 per square meter.
And how many are there supposed to be?
A healthy kelp forest, 2 per square meter.
2 urchins per square meter.
Yes.
And we had, wow, that's not good.
No.
And
they were piled on top of each other. And
okay, so two questions. You said upwards, you were looking at 150 acres? 130, 150.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you say acres, I think of that as a land measurement. So is that like the floor?
The floor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And yeah. Then second, why were they so overgrown?
There's a few reasons. Mm-hmm. Some of it is pollution and sedimentation issues, but the main factor is overfishing of predators of urchins. Main predator in Central California is otters. We do not have otters down here.
Is that because we killed them all?
They were almost hunted to extinction, and then they actually removed the ones that were down here up to San Nicolas Island, and then sea otters were not allowed to come south of Point Conception until, gosh, it was only like 4 years ago that they took that law off the books.
Okay. How can you even regulate? How can you be like sea otters? You're not allowed to swim south, first
right.
of all. And B, why did we do that?
So for the urchin fishery down here, I don't know all of the details, mm-hmm. but there was an agreement that it would be a no otter zone in Southern California.
That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Like, I get it if there are a bunch of people who have a specific economic interest and then they make deals with other people to say, you know, this is my region, that's your region. You can't make a deal with an otter
right.
and say, fool, you can't feed here because you're eating all of the fish or the sea urchins. You got to stay up north. Like, how do you even regulate something? That's so crazy.
Yeah. And their population hasn't grown enough to where they've expanded south, but every once in a while, you get a rogue juvenile male who exploring and
good.
They'll see it down here. But, you know, it's going to take a lot of time for them to come down here and they need healthy kelp forests for them to come live here. So that's what we're trying to do is get it ready for when they come down.
So, okay. A, this seems like a great kind of irony in that the interests of the kelp, or I should say the urchin fishermen, in protecting the interests of the urchin fishermen, otters were prevented from coming down. I mean, and they were already threatened, right? But they were prevented from coming down to eat up too many urchin. And in doing that, we ended up with too many urchin.
It's just a very small part of the story.
Oh, okay.
There's lots of other things.
But it definitely seems counterintuitive that in trying to ensure that there was enough to fish, we ended up with way more than we could ever fish.
Well, yeah. And the purples are actually not the commercial
gotcha.
Product. So the reds are the ones that we collect commercially.
So when you and I went, and by you and I mean I stayed on the boat and you actually did the diving. But then you collected up some urchins and we went back to the lab and dissected them, which was so cool. Were those the kind that people eat or were those the kind that people
eat? You can eat them, but they're not the commercial fishery. So the red urchins, the big ones that mm-hmm. we brought up, that's what you're going to find in your Japanese restaurant is uni.
Gotcha. Because it looked like uni, but you're right. It was
yeah.
small
yeah.
and it was sick.
Yes. So they have no food. They're just sustaining off the bioslimes on the reef, and they can stay that way for decades.
And that's the important point here, right? It's not that like, oh, more urchin, that seems like it's a good thing. Like, no, that's right. A really bad thing, because not only are there more, but they're unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And they're, so the otters and other things run off different sorts of waste products, make the urchin bloom. The urchin don't have enough food, so there's too many, but they're also sick. And then now there's not enough kelp because all the kelp's getting destroyed. And now there's not enough whatever. Like, right. One change can have this horrible cascade.
Yeah, and two other key species that we have in Southern California still are the sheephead and spiny lobsters. But you
is
need
a
to
sheephead
be,
a fish?
A sheephead is a fish.
Okay, yes. Thank you.
And you have to be a really big lobster and you have to be a really big sheephead to crunch into a sea urchin. So those are fished as well recreationally and commercially. So we have fewer large ones to help to put the population of urchins down. Mm. Also, if an urchin is sick and doesn't have anything in it, why would you waste your time trying to eat it?
Yeah, like you learn pretty quickly when you have a gross urchin.
I don't want to do that.
But like a spiny lobster, for example, is a really big crustacean. And yes. Then somebody's like, no, I want to eat that. So we fish those.
They're very tasty.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, this is complicated because you're not just dealing with trying to maintain. It's not like a Yellowstone story, right? Where, although that's the same kind of problem, where it's like an intersection between hunters and between ecosystem balance, and you want to make sure all the parties involved are really happy. Mm-hmm. Like, fish is a major part of the economy, isn't it?
Yes.
And so you've got, and you don't just want to be like, nobody can fish anymore, because that actually makes its own problems.
And that's not our position at all. Yeah. We're actually working with commercial fishermen to bring back mm-hmm. the kelp so that they're livelihood is sustained and there's fish to be caught, there's urchins to be collected, there's lobsters to be caught, and keeping it in balance so that it continues on.
Yeah, that's the whole point, right? Is that there's enough and there's abundance mm-hmm. and everybody's really happy and healthy. So some of them can stay in the ocean and some of them can be removed from the ocean and feed hungry bellies.
Yes.
Interesting. But also we want to be able to feed hungry bellies of the things that live in the ocean.
Correct.
Okay, so we collected all these super sick urchins back then, and you showed me how to dissect them, which was super fun, and we saw how super gross and sick they were. Yeah. And of course, you could see just in the images. I mean, you guys can watch this story anytime on YouTube or on KCET's website. Just look up Kelp Forest and my name, and you could see in the images how sick the kelp look, or just how missing the kelp is when there's just this sea of these little rocky urchins. So what's the difference? Like, what happens when you just remove some of them, and how do you remove them?
Well, we remove them by crushing them in situ. So mm-hmm. we go down, we take hammers and we crush them. The fish eat all of the gooey guts that come out. And once they're cleared, within 2 months, we'll have kelp sprouting on the reef.
So it's as simple as like single generational change sometimes. It's about making like a really concerted effort to say there's too many. If we cull them all as quickly as possible and manage the numbers, then it can rebound pretty quickly.
Yeah. And we're going to be starting year 6 of the project this summer. Our last report, we found a 250% increase in kelp canopy within 5 years. Increases in fish and inverts. I mean, everything's coming back. It's a slow process, but we're already seeing results. The one thing that will not come back is abalone.
Okay. So this is like the second half of this twisting mystery. I have to, before we talk about abalone, I have to ask, because a friend of mine figured this out the other day and it like blew his mind. And I thought it was kind of funny. Kelp is not a plant, is it?
No, it's not.
What is kelp?
It's an algae.
What? Yeah. So kelp is an algae and it's a really important food source, right? And a really important habitat source for a lot of organisms.
It's food and habitat.
Mm. So it's kind of like our version of the coral reef.
Yes. And also, you can compare it to a rainforest.
Oh, yeah. That might even be a better comparison. Although, not a plant. Remember that. Not an animal.
Yeah.
It's an algae. Okay, cool. All right.
So we always say kelp plant.
It's funny, right? So, I know. And it looks like a plant, at least in the water. Outside mm-hmm. of the water, I think it's easier to tell that it's not a plant. But in the water, I mean, we call it a kelp forest.
Yep.
Yeah.
And when you swim through it, it's like flying through a forest.
It really is, except it's a little bit slimy. But you kind of don't notice that when you're underwater.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Says the girl who's never underwater. By the way, when we were in that boat, I remember I was there in the boat with the cameraman. You and were there two other scientists on the boat?
Yeah, Tom Ford, our executive director, and my ex-coworker Ari was there.
So. Okay, yeah. And you guys all put on your wetsuits, put on your scuba stuff, went down, mm-hmm. And you were doing some work, you were taking some images, and we stayed up in the boat in the sun, and the boat was like docked, or it was like anchored sort of parallel to the shore, so it was catching the waves like sideways.
Oh, yeah.
And I was up there with like my almonds and my crackers and my, you know, whatever. And it was the first time in my life I've ever been seasick.
I didn't know you were seasick.
I was like, oh God, I hope they come back soon.
Oh my gosh. I'm so sorry.
It's totally not your fault. I was so glad that I thought to bring an umbrella.
I actually have a picture of you with the umbrella.
You do? That's
hilarious.
Yeah, I'll
have to find it and send it to you.
Yeah, so I'm lying on the on the kind of deck of the boat with the umbrella open over my face. And that was like so incredibly helpful to shield me from the sun. But there was something about, I guess it's not fun to go over waves sideways. That's how people get seasick, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty embarrassing to be seasick literally like 15 feet from the shoreline.
No, no. I get seasick.
Really?
Yeah.
Even though you're on boats all the time.
Yes.
And it's fine when the motors go, like when you're going.
Yes.
That's, you feel awesome.
It's
that's
usually
one of the best feelings.
When you're anchored, that'll happen sometimes.
Good. But, that makes me feel better because I was like, man, I am not good at this.
I know. I tell everybody who comes on the boat, I was like, don't be a hero. You feel sick. Nobody judges you.
You've got the vast ocean to be sick in. Okay, cool. That makes me all right. Sorry, random aside. So abalone. What is abalone? I've heard that word before, abalone. I've seen it written. What is it?
It's a marine snail.
Oh, it's a snail.
Yes.
But do people eat it?
Yes.
They do, right?
Yeah.
Here in the U.S., or is it more of a French thing?
It was a huge California culture to go down to the Rocky intertidal, go scuba diving, collect your abalone, grill it up. Like, that was what you did.
Oh, cool. So that was like a daytime fun thing. Oh, but there aren't any anymore.
There are not so many anymore.
Ugh.
And actually, in 1997, they closed the recreational fishery south of San Francisco. There was still a small recreational fishery open north of San Francisco, which unfortunately was closed this year because Northern California is now experiencing urchin barrens and lost their kelp.
Same problem.
And the abalone are starting to die up there.
So when you say recreational fishery, the difference there is that it's not like a net pin or like a big commercial thing where they're collecting to sell. It's where like any everyday people can just go and fish.
Right. There's a bag limit for the day. You're only allowed to, you know, collect them a certain way. You're only allowed to collect so many.
I remember for that story that we did, I woke up really early one day, like super early, like at 3 a.m. And we drove down. I can't remember where we were, but we had to be there before the sun came up at some like morning fish market. Mm. And it was so much fun, but it was so weird to see this whole like culture of, I don't know if you would consider them to be hardcore commercial fishermen or if there's sort of like an in-between, like people who go out just, it's like one person with one boat and then they bring in their haul for that day.
Yeah, there's definitely a range. You have very large commercial operations and then you do have, you know, the fisherman who owns his boat and he goes out for the day and brings back what he caught. But that's still a commercial fishery.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Okay, so recreational really is for like people who don't do this for a living.
Yeah, and you're not going to sell it. You're not allowed
to
sell
it. You're just going to eat it.
You're going to eat it or you're going to gift it to your neighbor.
Yeah.
Have a barbecue.
For sure. But now, does that mean that there aren't any left?
There are still some abalone up in Northern California.
Oh, I meant fisheries.
Oh, fisheries.
Like recreational fisheries. Like, are people allowed to even fish in the ocean now?
Oh, yes.
Oh, they are.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
okay.
It's just the abalone fishery.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So abalone super suffering, in there really aren't any, at least not here. And so people obviously can't go fish them. A, because it would be moot. You probably couldn't find any anyway. And B, if you did, like, you need to leave them where they are.
Right. So we have seven species off of our coast.
Okay.
Two of which are endangered. The rest of them are species of concern.
Okay.
The white abalone was actually the first invertebrate ever to be listed on the endangered species list.
Really? Ugh. So when was that? Do you remember?
I want to say 2008.
So white abalone has been endangered for a while, and now it's like what? Like, would you even be able to find it if you went? Well, you would because you know what you're doing.
there's very few of them out there. We do find one here and there. But there is a huge captive breeding program going on up at Bodega Marine Lab. So it's thought that there are more white abalone in captivity than there is in the ocean. It's been really successful. And the goal of that is to start outplanting them to the reefs. But there's a lot of steps that need to happen before we can do that. So we actually were doing some work with green abalone because they live in the more shallow part of the reef. We were restoring kelp forests, and we knew that abalone was a really important part of the kelp forest. We wanted to put it back.
And so abalone eat kelp?
They do, but they're not like the urchins. So the purple urchins will actually go attack the holdfasts of the kelp and will just decimate an entire forest. Abalone like to just hang out and wait for a blade to come by. They'll grab it. But they also compete for space. So they'll help keep urchins out of the reef.
Gotcha. So for them, it's not just a food source. It's also like a really important habitat.
Yes.
Okay. And when you said captivity, you know, it's easy to think of like, I don't know, a threatened animal, like a hippopotamus being, you know, bred in captivity or like, okay, it lives in a zoo. Like, what is captivity for ocean creatures? Is it in like big tanks or is it just in a walled off or pinned off part of the ocean?
No, this is all in tanks.
Oh, okay.
We also have our own aquaculture lab here in Southern California where we're keeping red and green abalone. We're expanding that lab so that when the white abalone outplanting starts, we'll be kind of a Southern California staging station for that. And so we'll have an entire room dedicated to white abalone. But yeah, they're just tanks, just like if you went to like an aquaculture farm.
Yeah, I went to an aquaculture farm when I was in Hawaii where they do aquaculture on seahorses because apparently... And it was like the first of its kind. It was like a really cool place because apparently seahorses are overfished for fish tanks. So it's a big problem because people want them in the fish tanks because they're so cool looking.
Right.
But it's just not a sustainable enough population to be able to go out and fish them all for that commercial use. And apparently, historically, you just couldn't farm them. But this one farm figured out some sort of like great plan to do it. And now it completely rebounded. Like in being able to have just this one farm in Hawaii, they can feed the need for seahorses in people's fish tanks. And nobody is fishing them out of the ocean anymore.
Cool. I know. I love when you hear a success.
Yeah,
like
it's so great. And now you can actually go visit this farm and you can put your hand in the tank and its tail wraps around your finger. And they have some of the fancy, like more rare ones, but then they just breed the normal ones too. And I don't know. And then you get to learn all about how they work and stuff. I was like, that's fun, right?
That's very cool.
But I bet you it's a little easier to rebound a species that people just want to look at because the hunger for just looking at something is completely different than the physical hunger for wanting to consume it.
Yeah, but there's also abalone farms. So you can still eat abalone. It's actually on the green list as long as you're getting it farmed.
Yeah.
And there's quite a few farms in California that you can purchase it from.
Can we talk about that for a minute? Because one of the first stories I ever did when I worked for... The reason that I'm fascinated by this, but also have a million questions, is that I don't eat seafood, personally. I don't like it. And so seafood culture is something I just don't have a lot of natural understanding of it. And when I worked for Al Jazeera, we did a story. It was the pilot episode on Techno years ago. And it was about... it was about salmon, coho salmon. And we went up to the Pacific Northwest. No, we went up to Alaska on a fisher boat. And it was like, oh, this is our culture. And I've had this boat multiple generations. There's a baby on the boat. It was crazy. and they were like, oh, and you would interview people at this like fish market. And they're like, oh, you only want to buy ocean caught salmon. I'm like, really? And then we went, it was all about GM salmon and some of the cool new technology that's going into making them grow faster, sooner in these farms so that we can basically feed a population of people who are just ravenous for salmon. And to me, from an intellectual angle, it seems so obvious that eating farmed fish is the way to do it if there is a fish in the ocean that is threatened. Like, you don't want to take the threatened fish out of the ocean if there's a sustainable farm that's set up for you. Why do you think that people are so like, ugh, farmed I don't want to eat farmed fish?
Well, there's been a lot of issues with farmed fish and, you know, their populations being released in the ocean and then mixing in with the wild populations. I think it scares a lot of people, and it's come a long way, but so a lot it's of people not
are,
perfect.
Gotcha. So a lot of people are thinking about what farm fish was like 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and like getting diseases or being not pinned in well or something like right. that. And they're not really up to speed on the newest kind of science. Gotcha. But it is a more sustainable way to eat, especially something that is threatened in the ocean, right? It's a caveated yeah. question, huh?
I think it depends on the species.
Gotcha. Okay. So some and really
and where it's coming from.
But there are ways to know this. Like you mentioned something called a green list. What is that? Like how can people inform themselves about how to make smarter decisions with their seafood?
Yeah. The Monterey Bay Aquarium comes out with a list every year. You can go online. They have little brochures you can pick up. And, you know, that's not a perfect list either, but it can help you make better choices when you're going out to eat or going to the fish market.
All right, everybody. I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Blue Apron. You can skip meal planning and get straight to cooking with Blue Apron because they have amazing meals that are great on the grill for the summer, like honey chipotle glazed chicken with poblano and lime rice. You can add smoky depth to your dinner while enjoying the warm weather and getting those perfect grill marks. Now, guys, I love Blue Apron because, like I mentioned, you can cook it any way you like. It's super convenient. There's a ton of variety. It helps you in case if you don't have time to get to the grocery store. It helps you if you're cooking for a small or a large group of people because the ingredients are pre-portioned and the recipe cards are step by step. And you can cook everything in under 45 minutes, which is just incredible. Also, the menu changes every single week based on what's in season. And it's designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. So you know you're getting the freshest, most creative options available, things that you probably wouldn't be cooking on your own. I love Blue Apron. I use it all the time. And I tell you, each time that I read a Blue Apron ad, that probably my favorite part of about Blue Apron is that it empowers me to feel like I can really cook because I am not that good. But honestly, more and more, I feel like I can do more things in the kitchen that maybe I wasn't feeling super confident about before. And that's a really big deal. I think that's super important. So guys, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/nerdy. That's three meals for free. You've just got to go to blueapron.com/nerdy.
Ready to become a leader? Enroll in Army ROTC. You could get a full tuition scholarship, and you'll graduate a leader and an officer in the U.S. Army. Army officers inspire strength in others. To receive more information about the Army ROTC program, visit goarmy.com/podcast today. Paid for by the United States Army.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. And also, fisher people use similar kinds of lists, don't they? To know, like, we're allowed this season to fish for this kind of species because it's in abundance this season, but this species is off limits this season because it's not doing so well.
Yeah, there's the Department of Fish and Wildlife in California, you know, there's many regulations for fishing. NOAA does a lot of stock assessments to look at populations of different species in the ocean. And then those all come together and create your regulations. But
that's good to know.
It's very complicated. There's a lot of, you know, this type of gear during certain types of seasons.
Yeah.
You know, can't fish on Fridays for this, and you can't fish it's like on our, Monday for that.
It's like our lawn watering schedule in Southern California. Yeah. But that comforts me to know that there are so many people involved, that there's so many programs that are trying to work really hard to restore a balance that's been really thrown out of whack. And of course, the Bay Foundation is working really hard to restore that balance. And it blows my mind that one of the ways that you can do that and that you're seeing really positive outcomes is literally just by looking at a specific key species and saying, what can we do to get this species in the numbers that are the most healthy with regard to the rest of the ecosystem? It's amazing to me that almost like surgically going in, like with laser focus and working on one individual organism, can have such a downstream effect on so many things.
Yeah, I mean, I count urchins all day. And just by focusing on the urchins, we're bringing back the kelp, which supports over 700 species. So how do you get to look at this big picture problem,
yeah,
and really hone in and figure out the root of that problem.
But it must be daunting when you're developing these plans and you're trying to, like, when you're actually taking a step back and looking at the forest for the trees and and making these big policy decisions about, like, this is going to be our initiative. We have to focus on urchin right now, or we have to focus on abalone right now, or whatever the case may be. Gosh, there's so many things you could work on. Like, how do you maintain that focus to say, you know what, this is a really important policy decision. This is what we have the resources for. This is what we understand. Like, we just got to stay the course. Because you've been working on kelp, you said, how many seasons now?
Well, that's just the part that we've been clearing off Palos Verdes. Kelp project started in 1998.
There you go. Okay. So yeah, this is a decades-long project.
Yeah.
You've been specifically working on the urchins for several years,
yeah,
and on culling the urchins as part of this bigger kelp project. So the kelp project is not just about urchins, right? It's about getting the kelp forest back in many ways.
Correct.
That's just so, it seems so daunting to me. Like, I think this is the struggle that a lot of science writers and science communicators have when they want to tell conservation stories, is they're like, God, conservation stories are so depressing because we are screwing up the planet. But then there's the flip side of that, which is that there's always this like amazing outcome when the resources are there and we're doing it right. And you guys are seeing that outcome, aren't you?
Yeah. And I think people get overwhelmed by the whole problem.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you got to look and say, well, what can we do? We can make this part of the coast a little bit better. We can go, you know, to this cove and make that a little bit better.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't solve the whole problem, but at least we're doing something and we're seeing results from it.
And the truth is, it does have an effect. Like, it's not like all the work that you do in this one little area is all for naught, because it just goes back to shit, like, the minute that you walk away. Like, you do something and you have a really focused effort, and then that thing has this chain reaction,
right,
which is so cool.
So we have pilot projects that were completed 2007.
Mm-hmm.
They're still sustaining kelp. Our current project, we're at 44 acres right now, which we're really proud of.
That's awesome. That sounds really big.
It is. Let's see. What can I compare it to?
I'm like, I have no concept. I am a city girl. I have no concept of 44 acres.
44 acres.
It's so weird to me, too, to think about coast. Or it's not even coast. It's like ocean in terms of acreage.
Yeah,
but I guess that's
coastal,
what you do. Coastal ocean.
Coastal ocean. So the seafloor.
Mm-hmm.
We like to try to calculate it in volume as well, because the kelp goes up. But
yeah,
you can't really report it that way.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha. Yeah. And how deep into the, like, does kelp grow just always? Or is it only up to a certain point?
No, it's only going to grow on rocky reefs. And
okay,
about 100 feet is its limit.
And okay, 100 feet. And
the photic zone.
We consider that a reef still, even though it's not coral. It's just a rocky reef.
Rocky reef.
I never knew that. Mm-hmm. There's rocky reefs and there's coral reefs.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And you said the photic zone, so the zone that the sunlight can reach,
yeah,
it?
Okay. Because they're photosynthetic, so they need light.
Yeah. Okay. I'm learning all these things. The ocean has always been, for me, a bit of a vortex, because to me, personally, it's super scary. I don't like to go in it. I've never scuba'd because the idea of scubaing makes me feel like really claustrophobic. And also when I've tried to snorkel and there were I don't like things that swarm.
Mm.
I sound so neurotic right now. things that swarm kind of scare me, and like,
yeah,
lots of marine life swarms, which is never fun. A lot of people, they'll be, you know, snorkeling and like a school of fish will say, oh my God, look at that school. It's just amazing. And I'm like,
you're running the other,
oh,
swimming the other way.
Yes. I'm so scared. and also there's something about it, which is probably simultaneously the thing that makes me so scared, but the thing that makes other people so enticed, which is that it's this unknown. It's like you have to convert yourself as a human being into a different kind of creature in order to be in the ocean or of the ocean. You know, we did not evolve to live underwater. And so like, to me, that's kind of an abyss that feels very wrong. But for a lot of people, I think the challenge or the transformation involved in going in and being in the ocean is really, like, magical to them.
It is. And I thought, before I started diving, I thought I would have the claustrophobic feeling as well. And, I mean, you do on the boat. You're, like, in your tight wetsuit and you're carrying all these heavy things. And then you get in the ocean and you really just feel so free. And you're weightless and you get to just float around. And, you know, you can go to the forest and not see any sort of wildlife. But you go into the ocean, there's all kinds of things. Everything is living around you.
That's true. You can't really avoid it. Like, you have to actually have a keen eye sometimes when you're in. I was just in the Peruvian Amazon a few months ago. And definitely the longer you're there. I was there for a week and, you know, day one, you're like, nothing. It's so weird. I expected to see all these living creatures and I see nothing.
Right.
And then by the end, you're like, oh, there's things here. Like, I just didn't really know how to look for them.
And whereas, that happens in the ocean as well.
That's cool.
When I first started diving, looking for abalone, they look like rocks. So
yeah, that's not easy.
Like, somebody would point to something. I'm like, yeah, that's a rock. And then I'm like, oh, okay, got it. So I got the search image.
And is that because they have a shell?
Yeah, they have a top shell that often has a lot of things growing on it. And it's shaped like a rock and colored like the rocks.
I mean, that's good camouflage, right? Yes, it protects them. But then there's like this squishy thing underneath that apparently people like to eat, which to me, I just still can't deal. I'm like, I don't want to eat a sea snail, but whatever.
They're actually quite delicious.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are. Okay. So back to the abalone. Is this a downstream effect of just getting the kelp forest where it needs to be? Or how are you kind of more actively helping the abalone to rebound?
Yeah. So the abalone, there's too few of them in the ocean. And they're broadcast spawners, so that means that there needs to be quite a few of them near each other in order for them to reproduce.
Broadcast spawners.
Yes.
Like, they are broadcasting the fact that they are ready to mate?
No, they're going to release their eggs and sperm just into the water column.
Gotcha. And so then is it like male and female mate together?
Yes.
Okay, so one of
not mate together, they have males and females separate.
So males and females both release, and then they just, like, swirl together.
Then they mix in the water column.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then they'll stay in the water column in the lab, we see them about 7 days before they want to settle. There have been studies that show that it could be weeks that they're in the water column traveling.
Just kind
around.
Of swirling around.
Yeah.
And then eventually they settle on the floor?
They do. They look for some sort of cue that shows them that they're in good habitat. Coralline algae, which is this kind of pink algae, red algae that forms on the rocks. That's kind of a cue because that shows them that that's good habitat. It's also believed that abalone attract abalone.
Mm.
So if you smell an abalone, you're like, oh, maybe this is a good neighborhood. I should come down here and live.
Wow, that's so weird. That's really neat.
Yeah.
Okay, and then they grow up to be healthy and strong, and then eventually they repeat the whole process over again. So
right, and they're very slow growing, so it can take 5 to 10 years before they're spawning.
Oh, wow. So that seems like that's another thing that always has, like, confused me. Well, I guess farming is the same way, really, and hunting and all of that. That, like, it just seems like such a waste that this organism that takes so long to be mature, then just, like, we eat it. You know, it's like, I feel like we should be eating things that are, like, have, like, a quick turnaround.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because
that
seems more sustainable. But obviously, it's not been sustainable the way that we managed this stuff in the past. But now you guys are really working to have a more sustainable approach. So, like, what is it that you do? Like, is it really just about getting the kelp where it needs to be?
That's kind of the first step in what we're doing off Palos Verdes. One of our initial projects was a green abalone outplant project. So we took about 900 juvenile green abalone, which they were about 10 millimeters to 50 millimeters.
Oh,
put
they're
them in
tiny.
These, yeah, they're tiny.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Stuck little bee tags on them. Oh. She would put, like, on a queen bee, glued those on so we could try to find them.
Does the glue not dissolve in the ocean?
Eventually.
Okay.
I mean, we found shells for the first year with tags on them. Haven't found many tagged animals or shells recently.
Gotcha. But, so it's a nice short-term way to count them.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the idea is that they just really start to repopulate once you seed them there?
Well, that's the hope. You know, and it takes a long time. So we put these abalone out in 2015, went out every month doing surveys, and eventually we weren't finding any anymore. And we're like, okay, where did they go? Kept doing surveys. A couple of years later, there was abalone everywhere.
Oh.
So when they become a certain, you know, when they're little, they want to go hide because they don't want to be eaten by the octopus and all the other things that think they're yummy like we do. So they go deep into the reefs where you can't really find them. And then as they get larger, they come out and they emerge.
Okay.
So that is what we're seeing. We don't have any tags, so we haven't been able to say, like, yes, that abalone came from our outplants. So we've been collecting some genetic samples from them, trying to, like, do parentage and all these things with them. But
you can, I mean, even without knowing specifically the source of them, you are seeing a difference between, like, the numbers before this and
yeah,
now?
Yeah, so...
That's the important thing, right?
Our initial survey, we found 10... juvenile green abalone at the site. So this was also a site that we restored. We took, I think the urchins were at about 70 per square meter there.
Gotcha. So you go in, you cull all the urchins, you get it to a point where the balance is where it needs
to be. Yeah, the kelp came back. We started seeing coral and algae on the rocks. We're like, okay, now it's ready to put the abalone in.
Gotcha. So this is a long process.
It was. Yeah.
Yes, and I was down there doing it by hand.
I know every rock in this spot.
And how big is this little, like, this pilot area?
10 by 10 meters.
Meters. Okay, so, cool. So manageable.
Yeah.
And in that area, you were saying how many urchins is a healthy amount in 10 by 10? One?
Well, two per square meter, so you'd...
Oh, by times 10. Okay, gotcha, gotcha. And then I got to do it in both directions.
Yeah.
This is a nice... See, Talk Nerdy is fun because you get to do math on your own because I'm not going to tell you the answer because I don't want to do it. Okay, so you know, it's 10 by 10 is actually kind of big. Not really, though.
It's not
like
that
it's
big.
Manageable.
It was a manageable area that we could go back to and survey.
And then do you just, like, stick stakes in the ground with, like, ropes? Like, how do you know what the boundaries are?
We have transect tapes.
Okay.
So we'll lay those out. We have a marker down there so we know where to start each time. So we're starting in the same place.
So you can be really systematic and scientific about it. Okay. So you cull the urchins. You get the urchin population to where it needs to be. The kelp starts to grow back. You start to see all these other organisms living there and looking happy and healthy. And then you actually took baby abalone, teeny tiny abalone from the lab and, or from this, this.
Yeah. These grew up, actually at the Sea Lab in Redondo Beach.
The Sea Lab.
Yeah.
Like the cartoon.
So they were our partner on the Green Abalone Project.
Cool. Okay.
So they spawned them in the lab and grew them there. Mm-hmm. And once they were large enough and our site was ready, we took them and put them in these, 10 inch diameter PVC pipes. And then swam down to the ocean floor, stuck them in there, and waited.
So you kind of gave them, like, mini habitat to hang out.
Yeah, it was a
there?
Way to transport them down easily and had a nice opening so that they could just go out onto the reef.
Do whatever they wanted to
and
do.
Part of our permit requirement was that, you know, we had to obviously remove the PVC pipes after the abalone left, and everybody was like, what if the abalone don't leave?
Yeah.
so we really had no idea, but they ran.
Oh,
so as soon as you put it down there, we have a little bit of video, which I'll have to put up on YouTube or something, but it was like, oh, ocean. And they just crawled right out of the tubes and disappeared.
So is that, because I'm thinking of a snail and I know what a snail looks like on land. They just, like, slime away. They just go. So they don't swim.
No, okay. they crawl.
They crawl. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And they're just sticky. So they kind of stick.
They have very strong foot.
And
so they kind of, it almost looks like they're walking. They move their foot kind of back and forth and
cute.
Yeah. They're very cute. They're the most charismatic snail I've ever met.
And these were, of course, are these the same little buggers that were only 10 millimeters when you first brought them down?
Yeah, 10 to 50.
10 to 50.
They ranged in size.
Still small.
Yeah, they're pretty small.
And then is that not full grown?
No.
Okay.
They, a very large abalone can be 200 millimeters is some of the ones we're collecting off Catalina.
Yeah, because I'm like, that doesn't sound like food, 10 to 50 millimeters.
No.
Yeah, okay.
No.
Like, that's not like, very difficult.
You want, the farms sell them at about 3 inches.
Okay. Yeah. That makes more sense. That's like what a snail looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you did notice that they got off the PVC quickly.
Yes.
And now when you look back in this pilot area, there's more than
there
were.
And the size classes that we're finding, like, pretty much line up with how they would have grown over the 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether they're ours or not, there's abalone there. And that is awesome.
Yeah.
So we're really excited about that. And there would not have been abalone there if the urchins were there. There's no way that they could have found enough food or places to live there. So.
Gotcha. So it's not a function of the urchins taking over the abalone. It's a function of the urchins taking over the kelp and the abalone having no kelp left.
Right.
And so you're seeing these positive outcomes. What are some other key indicators that it's working? I mean, obviously you can count the snails, you can count the urchins, you can look at whether or not the kelp is thick or thin, or non-existent. Are you looking at other animals to see like what kinds of creatures are hanging out that maybe didn't want to hang out before?
Yeah. So we actually partner with the Vantuna Research Group at Occidental College, and they do our biological assessment surveys every year. And the list of species that they're looking for is very extensive. So,
yeah.
I mean, they're looking for everything. We're tracking everything.
Good.
In the kelp forest. And even on top of that, we've started doing some physical and chemical research with a researcher up at UC Davis looking at wave attenuation and kelp's ability to buffer ocean acidification.
So yeah, it's not just about food.
No, it's about protecting our coast, creating refuge for animals in the face of climate change.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I think that's like the key thing here is that these kinds of outcomes are really fundamentally because of things that we did. Like, we're the actors in this play, right? Which is why we, and by we, I mean you and your incredible teams, are working so hard to sort of undo the human caused damage, whether it be from pollution, from the change in climate, which we have very, very good data that is that are linking it to human activities, whether it's from overfishing. All of these things are human things.
Yes. And so it's up to us to try to help.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, do you think that like your everyday kind of person is really acutely aware of how sick the oceans have become?
I think it depends on where you are.
Yeah. You think like Californians or at least coastal Californians?
I think coastal Californians are pretty connected to their ocean.
Yeah. I mean, even from the time, I don't know, because I've only lived here, you know, since I was like 24. So kind of similar to you. I was definitely pleasantly surprised that every storm drain has a little picture on top.
Right,
that's
yeah.
like, no dumping. This is going to end up in the ocean
right.
eventually. Those little kinds of reminders that you almost think of as subconscious reminders. I think people here have been living with them their entire lives.
Yeah. And it was a shock to me too. Cause I mean, everything went to the sewage treatment plant where I was from. So
heck yeah. And then like, no, it was all just like garbage in the sewer, you know, it's like downstream detritus and like, I don't know. And there are little raccoons that would eat most of it. Like we had a lot of raccoons living in the sewers.
Yeah.
But yeah, here there is kind of a more, I think, reverent understanding or respect. And I also think that like, we're in an era right now where at least plastic, you know, I think things trend up, like we're super aware of plastic bags and then we're super aware of plastic straws. And then we're really, really aware of overfishing salmon. And, you know, there's like different things that capture the public's attention at different times. But I am happy to see that this sort of environmental movement or the green movement, which was sort of trendy in the 70s, is now just a way of life for many people.
Yeah, but I think it has a long way to go.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, so maybe the reason that it seems so obvious to us is because we actually live here. But people who live even just a little bit inland or who live in the middle of America.
Yeah, you know, there's nonprofits that work with school children that just live a few miles inland. They've never seen the ocean, you know, and bringing them in buses to experience it. So, you know, there's there's a lot of work to be done. And I think that that's kind of why LA has so many environmental nonprofits, because there are so many different issues to deal with that, you know, no single one could do it.
Yeah. And really, we're in a super special. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I love it here. Growing up in Texas, and then I lived in New York for a year, but in the city. And then I came to LA and I was really excited and sort of marveled at the fact that we have so many different ecosystems so close to each other here.
Yeah.
You don't have to drive far to be in the mountains or be in the desert or be in at the ocean or be in the city and or the forest. And there, I mean, the amount of biodiversity is just stunning.
Yeah, California is amazing.
It's so...
I love being here.
Oh, it's so... And also the weather is great and also the people are great. And oh, but there's too much traffic. Don't come here. Don't come here. No. Come. It's fun. It's fun. Yeah. So, okay. I want to ask you then, as a person who has really dedicated your life to doing these conservation oriented scientific activities, right? Because you're not just studying these things. You're not just collecting data. That's a big part of your job, but
it is a big part of it, but no, that is not.
Yeah. But then you're taking that data and you're making useful decisions and really acting on those data to affect change. I would love then, like, for some news you can use, because I do think that a lot of times people who are, you know, living in their apartments in the middle of downtown, or maybe somebody's listening to this episode from, you know, a flat in London, or they live in Wisconsin or whatever, you know, the ocean does feel really far away from them. Mm-hmm. And the climate change does feel like an insurmountable problem that we're never going to be able to solve. But the truth of the matter is, like, we can make really personal decisions in our lives that have a big impact, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are some of the recommendations that you give when you talk to school children, or that you tell your friends about, where you're like, I see the effect of this? Like, these are the kinds of things we can be doing because they actually have a positive impact that I can physically see.
Yeah, probably the thing I see and get disturbed by most is trash in the ocean.
Okay. So, and that's the easiest. It's like, don't.
I think that's the easiest thing that anybody anywhere can do is, you know, think about what you're using and do you really need to use this one use item? Is there another way to address this? And don't throw it on the street.
Yeah. So it's about the things that you use, like single use plastics, which we know are terrible.
Yes.
Because a lot of them are going to end up in the ocean, regardless of where you put them. But B, it's about making sure that if you do use them, that they go into the recycling bin or they go. Yeah.
Yeah.
And even though we know that there's some of that is still probably going to end up in the ocean somehow, even if you're really mindful about throwing it away, like that's the first step. But yeah. Then also, don't use it in the first place is really helpful.
That's what I tell people.
Yeah, reusable.
And I try to do it myself, but, you know, it's hard.
It's hard because until, I agree, I mean, sorry to be soapboxy, but I feel like until we have stronger government regulation that make it so it's no longer an option, it's a function of convenience. We've all been on a road trip and we have our reusable plastic bottle, but we haven't been to a restaurant and there's nowhere to fill it up. And
right.
So we have to buy bottled water and there's no glass ones in the thing. So you have to buy the plastic ones. But if there were no plastic ones, we would just be.
Right. That would just be our way of life.
Exactly.
And it would become normal.
Yeah. Same thing with straws, like plastic straws are just the worst. It's hard.
Straws.
It's hard though, because like I have super sensitive teeth. And so I'm so used to using straws to prevent my teeth from hurting, but I'm just having to suck it up and say like, put your mouth on the cup, Kara.
Right.
You can deal with it. Or now they have these great little collapsible ones that you can carry in your
handbag. Yeah. Stainless steel straws, you know,
yeah.
But then you got to remember to clean it.
It's
true. At the bottom of your purse.
Or even reusable plastic is a step up, right?
Yeah.
Like I have a reusable plastic bottle that I'm drinking out of right now. And yeah, it's plastic, but I mean, this thing will not go in the trash. Or if it does, it will be like 10 years from now. That's just how it
and
works.
The amount of water bottles that you would have bought to,
oh my gosh,
you know,
can you
the
imagine?
Amount of times you filled it.
Yeah. So I had a guest on the show named Lori Winkless, who wrote a book about cities and about the science of the city. And it went everywhere from sort of architectural feats, engineering feats, all the way down to well, really, I guess this is also an engineering feat, but let's say from bridges and buildings all the way down to like sewage systems and things like that. And she talked a lot about fatbergs, like in the sewage system under big cities like London. Fatbergs are the grossest thing ever. Look them up.
I've never heard of them.
Yeah, it's what happens when cooking oil goes down the drain and then combines with like flushable wipes and like all these things that, and hair and things that stick together. And they form these massive thing that have been known to crack sewage pipes. There have been ones that are the size of city buses. Like, it's amazing and disgusting. And it's like, oh my God, people are so gross.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. But one of the things that she talked about on the show, which really resonated with me, is that like we use terms and we don't think about the terms, like throw it away. She's like, and she was like, what is this away we're speaking of? There is no away. And I think that's a really important thing to remember. Like, even after you use something and you quote unquote, you put it in the bin that's outside your house, it goes somewhere.
Right.
It doesn't just go to some magical giant vortex, like black hole. Something happens to it. And more often than we would like to admit, it goes into the guts of a seabird, or it strangles, you know, turtle, or it just builds up in landfills or on the ocean, you know, like that we have this Pacific garbage patch. It's a real thing. Mm-hmm. You can't see it because it's all broken up into teeny tiny pieces, but it's there. Have you had to encounter that a lot? Like teeny tiny pieces of plastic?
Yeah, we see that.
Even by the coast?
Yeah.
Ugh, that's depressing. And it, like the, and the organisms, like they mistake it for plankton, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, there's filter feeders and things that, you know, there's no way they're not going to ingest it.
I don't want to get depressed. We're going to change the subject. We're getting close to the end. Can you believe it? Can you believe we've been chatting for a whole hour? Okay. I always ask my guests the same two questions when we get close to the end of the show, because I always love to hear their perspectives, because my guests, I'm very lucky that I get to talk to very smart people from all over the world that come from incredibly different scientific disciplines. And I haven't had an ocean person on in a really long time, so this is really exciting. I want you to think about the future, which I'm sure you do all the time. It's a big part of your job, right? Mm-hmm. But you do it in your private life, too. We all do. I want you to think about the future, and I want you to think about it in two different ways, and you can tell me what those ways are. The first one is when you're thinking about the future, there are big problems. Big pressing problems, things that keep you up at night, things that make you concerned, like truly concerned. So the first thing is I want you to tell me, like, what, if you had to pick one thing, which I know it's hard to do, what is the thing that like really you struggle with? The thing that maybe even sometimes makes you a little cynical, makes you a little depressed, makes you feel a bit overwhelmed. But then on the flip side of that, I want you to tell me what is the thing that you actually are really hopeful for. And when you look at the future, you say like, a difference is being made. Like we're trending in the right direction.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think just the vastness of the ocean and how many issues there are between climate change, loss of species, overfishing. I mean, there's no end to the list of problems.
Yeah.
But I also get to work with amazing people that are doing amazing work all over the world. And that's a really inspiring thing. And so knowing that there's this whole network of people that are passionate about the same thing I am, it kind of keeps me going.
I love that. And, you know, we talk a lot. I think the phrase I use often when you're like in the thick of it is like, you're boots on the ground, but you're not. You're like fins in the water. But you get to see the effects firsthand. And it's like your eyes are open to this place where when positive change occurs, there's a physical manifestation of it. Like you get to go, abalone are coming back.
Yeah. And I don't know how many times I've been doing a survey and I literally just put my slate down because I found an abalone and I just watch it for a little while.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I guess I should get back to work.
I love that. That's so great. I mean, I think that sometimes when we have these conversations or we listen to these kinds of things in podcasts and whatnot, or we watch these documentaries, it starts to feel very specific and very like nitpicky. It's like, oh, you know, every day you're counting and you're calculating and you're looking at this one specific species, but it really is a stand-in for the ocean as a whole. It's one piece of the problem that's manageable. Yeah. And it, again, I keep saying it has these amazing downstream effects. And that's why I thought it was so important to talk to you about it.
Well, we love telling our story and we want more people to know about it. So thanks for having us here.
So how can people like get involved? If people are like, man, the Bay Foundation sounds awesome. I want to learn more. I want to go meet these people. I want to give. Like, what are different ways that people can be involved?
Yeah, the easiest way to find us is on the web. It's santamonicabay.org.
Mm-hmm.
But we have volunteer events almost every Saturday.
Oh, cool.
So our watershed programs, we have things going on at the Malibu Lagoon. We have a Culver City rainwater capture project.
Oh, cool. So you don't have to live like right by the ocean.
Oh, no. We have projects. LAX Dunes is another project we do. But then also we send out calls for special events like the urchin dissections. We do those in the fall and we need many, many people to help us.
Oh, cool. So really there's a way like... So you can, I'm assuming, give financially if you
don't
live. Yeah, you can go on the website. You can give financially. You can learn. But there's also a way to do citizen science with you.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I love citizen science. It makes me happy. Guys, you've got to check it out. Okay, cool. So go to the web. Learn more about it. See how you can be involved. Heather, this was so much fun. I've got to thank you for taking the time out of your important and busy schedule to come to the studio and to chat with me.
Thank you.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.